This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In the NFL, it's no surprise that huge, powerful athletes can get hurt when they collide with each other at full speed. It is surprising if they're paid to injure their opponents with those hits. That's what a report commissioned by the Football League reveals. It found that the former defensive coordinator for the New Orleans Saints ran a program that paid players thousands of dollars for big hits. As NPR's Mike Pesca reports, the consequences of the scandal could be far-reaching.
After the New Orleans Saints won their only Super Bowl 2 years ago, their defensive coordinator Greg Williams was exultant. Not only had his team pressured and stymied the great Peyton Manning, they did it via Williams' signature style.
My whole life, I've been trying to speed up people's decisions, get people to play faster, get people to play nastier, get people to play tougher or more aggressive.
These people who Williams tried to imbue with aggression included, he soon noted, his own sons. Top athletes, Williams said, but once just small children.
I told their little league coaches, my kids will play fast, they're going to play nasty, they're going to play tough. Please don't slow them down. Tell the rest of the babies around them to speed up, because I'm going to be hot if you slow my kids down.
The league has slowed, if not outright halted, Williams. He was aware of and at times oversaw a program whereby players on his defense were paid thousands of dollars for big hits. The rewards would go up if opponents were carted off the field. Subsequent news stories indicate Williams oversaw similar programs when he was with the Redskins and Bills. When news of the bounty program broke, many NFL players were quick to opine and tweet that this was nothing new. Players have long been incentivized to deliver big blows. It is the reality of the NFL. But there were nuances and details of the Saints program that surprised many players. Carl Mecklenburg, a six-time Pro Bowl defender with the Denver Broncos, says he played to win, to survive, for his job and for his teammates. He didn't need a cash for Clobber's program, but he was privy during his playing career to some extra incentivization.
At one point when I was playing for the Broncos, where the big plays, you know, whether it's a tackle for a loss or a sack or a big hit that changes the momentum of the game. And that's, you know, on the discretion of the coaches. Those things would be awarded points. And at the end of the year, the person with the most points got a little trophy and got an incentive trip.
College teams affix stickers to helmets for big plays. Teams might give you a game ball for a big hit. But in none of those cases is it clear that the intent of the award is to put opponents out of games. That's why Mecklenburg says the league should punish the Saints. That's why Gabe Feldman, director of the Tulane Sports Law Program, says the NFL must aggressively root out a bounty system to keep criminal and civil liability at bay.
I think it was important for them to come forward, do an investigation, and then discipline the involved parties. And I think that would be one of the main reasons why a criminal court wouldn't step in, because they'd see this as league business, and a reason why a court might not step in and award damages and say this is just part of the game and the league is handling under their own rules.
Part of the game. That is the phrase that the NFL is leaning on as it faces multiple lawsuits over head injuries. The NFL's self-preservation depends upon the argument that injuries are part of the game. Were they to countenance bounties, that argument comes crumbling down. Greg Williams, however, may not be part of the game very long. He left the Saints a few weeks ago to take the defensive coordinator job with the Rams, but he could be suspended for all or part of the upcoming season. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.
Some other news now. A new study explores a question that has occurred to almost anybody who's looked at an expensive bottle of wine and wondered if it was really that much better than the one that costs a few bucks. As NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, the answer may depend on your biology.
When I got the assignment to look into the science of wine-tasting subtleties, the obvious place to go was a wine shop.
You are in Schneider's of Capitol Hill, and my name is John Genderson.
As we navigate the narrow rows of his shop, I ask Genderson if he could find us a wine that the experts of the wine world, the people who come up with those ratings, absolutely love.
There's quite a few.
He places his hand on the neck of one bottle.
A Charme Chambertin from this great producer, Domaine du Blair.
And the price tag?
It's $150.
Oh, wow.
Charme Chambertin Grand Cru.
Okay,
so $150. That one's very, very expensive, very highly rated and very expensive.
Gunderson says in the high-end wine world, ratings really do drive prices and trends, and reviews are based on a complicated vocabulary that lots of us pretend to understand.
It's soft. The tannins are balanced and integrated into the wine. It has lovely fruit.
But as Gunderson talks in this language of wine, I realize to some extent he's lost me. I mean, sure, I can fake it, but honestly, I don't know how to detect notes of plum or eucalyptus. Now, it's possible that with some training, I could learn. But it's also possible that what separates me from experts like Gunderson is a matter of biology as well. That's what scientist John Hayes thinks.
It may be that he actually has different physiology in his mouth and nose and brain that allows him to pick out some of those nuances that no matter how much training you have, you'll never find.
Well, okay. But Hayes and some of his colleagues at Penn State have just published a study that offers some proof of this theory, that in the world of wine tasting, there are super tasters, and then there are the rest of us.
Well, we evaluated about 330 wine drinkers with a specific bitter chemical that measures tasteability. And when we did that, we found that the wine experts, people like winemakers or wine judges or wine writers, were much more sensitive to the bitterness of this chemical.
It's similar to the studies that have found super tasters are more sensitive to the sweetness of sugar, the spiciness of chilies, or saltiness of chips. So if it turns out that lots of us don't or can't taste the subtleties of fine wines, it makes me wonder, why do people pay for them? Outside the wine shop, I asked a group of law students, including Jim Stanton.
I think a lot of times when you pay more for a bottle, you sometimes don't want to admit to yourself that it's not something good.
But now that we know that lots of us can't taste the difference, maybe we won't feel insecure about sticking with our more economically priced favorites. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
There is little dispute among educators that many kids are not reading as well as they need to be. But there is endless debate over what to do about it. Now, a growing number of states are taking a more hardline approach. They say third graders who can't read at grade level will automatically be held back. As NPR's Tovia Smith reports, some believe that strategy will hurt more than it helps.
To those pushing the idea, it's equal doses of tough and love. You're not doing a kid any favors, they say, by waving him on to fourth grade if he isn't up to snuff on his reading.
It's essentially just lying to the kid to say that you're there. And I think what we need to do is to draw a line in the sand and have the fortitude to step up and say, this is the right thing for kids.
Tim Taylor is with a group of business leaders pushing the idea in Colorado. As educators like to say, third grade is when kids move from learning to read to reading to learn. So if kids don't yet have basic reading skills, Taylor says, they need to stay back.
It's a gift of time. It is giving the kids the ability to get to the reading levels that they need so that they can be successful moving through their school career.
Similar bills are being considered in New Mexico, Iowa, and Tennessee, and have recently passed in Oklahoma, Arizona, and Indiana. Advocates point to Florida, where schools started mandatory retentions 10 years ago. Reading scores of kids who repeated third grade went from way below average to well above, impressing many, like New Mexico Education Secretary Hannah Scandera.
That data that I've seen looks pretty darn remarkable. Florida's Hispanic students alone are ahead of 31 other states' total student populations in fourth grade reading.
Well, of course, they're a year older. That's the stupidest. Of course they're going to do better when they get into fourth grade.
David Berliner, Arizona State University professor emeritus, says even in Florida, the gains faded by eighth grade. In the long term, he says, holding kids back tends to do more harm than good.
It's just mean-spirited. If you're willing to spend an extra $10,000 to give the kid another year of schooling, why aren't you willing to put some money into a tutor over the next 2 years? That's what we ought to do, not leave them back, but get them the resources.
Cam would see why they...
Okay, let's start back, because it seems like here we started to not look at the first letter in the words.
So at a third grade class in Cambridge, Massachusetts, struggling readers get extra help from teachers like Jocelyn Marshall.
It's very effective, so we're just sort of trying to catch them in every way we can and give them extra reinforcement. But it can be tough with having, 20 students in a class, and we can't get to that one-on-one with every kid all the time.
Marshall says she's seen the downside of promoting kids before they're ready, but she's also seen the problems with keeping kids back. It saps their self-esteem and, research says, also lowers parents' and teachers' expectations of them. Noni Lusseau, professor at Harvard School of Education, says kids who stay back also end up more likely to drop out.
Everything we know about retention suggests it's potentially very traumatic. And socially, it's very stigmatizing.
When we talk about stigma and concerns, illiteracy is the stigma that we need to address.
New Mexico's Hannah Scandera says retention alone is not an answer, but when coupled with early intervention and extra instruction, it is an important last resort.
This is not, you know, a gotcha policy. It's a ensure our kids are ready for success policy.
Trouble is, so far, there's no clear answer on whether the policy actually works.
Quite frankly, both sides will overstate what the little bit of research available says.
Ralph Smith of the Annie E. Casey Foundation says holding kids back is often seen as easier than developing lots of differentiated learning plans or investing, for example, in summer school.
There are many people who are seizing on retention because they are looking for an easy answer to a complicated problem.
As another academic put it, this policy flunks kids for failing to learn, but given how widespread the problem is, maybe it's the school that should flunk for failing to teach. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, do you think the term vegetarian feast is an oxymoron? Well, Bryant Terry is ready to convince you that vegetarian cooking can be savory, satisfying, even soulful. He'll talk about his new book, The Inspired Vegan, in a few minutes. But first, we turn to matters of personal finance, and it is no secret that the recession has put a dent in many American savings. And many people might still have that idea of that picture postcard retirement, including days at the golf course or relaxing beside the pool or trips to far-off places. According to Julia Valentine, author of the book Joy Compass, How to Make Your Retirement the Treasure of Your Life, if you plan now, you might still be able to salvage those dreams. And Julia Valentine is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here, Michelle.
I just want to mention that you spent a lot of years on Wall Street before you turned into kind of helping people manage their finances. And I just wanted to ask if you could just briefly tell us how you got interested in the idea of personal money management after you spent a lot of time, you know, helping companies create wealth.
You know, I was surprised at how little people know, well-educated people know about managing their finances, and things that were very, very easy to me, but I had an MBA, of course, were really a revelation to them, including my own family. And
there was an experience in your family, yeah. If you don't mind telling us briefly.
My grandparents retired at 55, and they were all set. And then unexpectedly, they invested in the money pyramid scheme. And for about 3 years, they were making 90% returns on their money. And on year four, you know, they actually lost everything. And the family said, no worries, we'll help you out. Don't stress out about it. But they couldn't. They were so involved in processing this experience that eventually my grandmother had two strokes. And she was half paralyzed for many years. and it was a very traumatic event. It just it made it personal for me, let's put it this way.
And you have, a lot of your reporting suggests, and you've cited, you know, in fact, we on this program have also cited numerous studies that demonstrate mm-hmm. that a lot of Americans, despite the fact that, you know, financial planning, financial advice has become something of a cottage industry, mm-hmm. that many Americans don't have any idea of how much money they will need to retire, mm-hmm. don't have a budget, don't have any, even a figure,
yes.
you know, in mind. Why do you think that is?
One of the issues there is that psychology hasn't really found its way into financial affairs. And what I mean by that is there are now studies that say there is such a thing as future self-continuity. What is that? It means that can I imagine myself 30 years from today? And there is research being done actually at NYU, one of my alma maters in New York, and psychology professors are saying that if we're shown our own picture using simple aging software, and it shows you this is me 30 years from today, people who actually see this save more. They put away more money. Apparently, it's not a simple thing for us to connect with, hello, my future self, you know, 30, 40, 50 years from sure. today. And what's really interesting is that now they're saying, let's take this to human resources department. Let's take this and build it into financial tools. And a psychologist I respect immensely, Dan Ariely, he essentially said, there is a product design flaw in the way that we do financial tools. So if you're using a retirement calculator, for example, it doesn't tell you how you're going to feel if you save $40,000, $400,000, $40 million. There's no emotional connection there. And there's no ability to visualize what it's going to feel like if you're 89 and you don't have enough money to cover your monthly expenses.
We're talking with Julia Valentine. She's the author of the book Joy Compass, How to Make Your Retirement the Treasure of Your Life. And we're talking about some of the common mistakes that people make in planning for their futures. Let's walk through some of those. You recently mm-hmm. Wrote a piece about six perennial pitfalls mm-hmm. that people make. And the first one is taking financial advice from friends and family over professionals. You said that people routinely take financial advice from people like their hairdressers and their people who do their nails.
They really do. They really do. Oh, look, Facebook made an industry out of this, you know. You like something, you click on, I like this, and people go and buy it. We are designed, we're built this way. We heavily weigh opinions of people we come across very often. It's a natural thing to do.
And, you know, it's interesting because we often hear about these schemes involving people like professional athletes who come mm-hmm. into a lot of money, you know, suddenly mm-hmm. and then, you know, lose it all. And we think, well, that's just them. And you're saying this is actually a fairly common problem.
Oh, this is us. This is not them. This is us. It's not a bad idea to hear something from someone, but you need to be aware of two things. First of all, emotional dynamics are very, very different around family, around friends. It's more difficult for us to stand up, say no to them. And secondly, financial literacy. Look, people underinvest in financial research. We don't like to read the fine print. Who does? It's boring. It's tedious. It's, you know, it's something that people skip over. And so if you hear an idea, I'm not saying it's a good idea or a bad idea. I'm saying do your research and be aware that there is an emotional dynamic involved.
Well, you have a couple of points around the whole mm-hmm. idea of doing your research that you say another couple of common mistakes that people make are underestimating inflation, withdrawing too much money early on in retirement. And this might sound like a simple thing, but lacking a financial plan. Talk a little mm-hmm. bit about that, if you would.
A financial plan doesn't mean that you plan your life in 15-minute increments. So to all the people who tell me I'm not a planner, the first thing that I ask them is, have you ever planned a vacation? Oh, yeah. Have you ever planned a wedding? Oh, I've planned five of them. You know. So don't tell me you're not a planner. Everyone is.
Let's talk about failing to adjust the asset allocation in your portfolio with time. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, the appropriate asset allocation is going to depend not only on your risk preferences, how aggressive you are, how conservative you are. It's also going to depend on your time frame. So as you are getting closer to retirement, the amount of time you have for your investments to rebound from a down cycle. And, of course, we live in a cyclical economy, is less. So you need to continue looking at your asset allocation every year.
Every year.
And a lot of people, you know, we can say 5 years, but I'm being conservative here because for a lot of people who hear us, you know, they might be nearing retirement. So I'll say take a look at it every year. Make sure that you are where you want to be. Quite a few people allocate their funds and then leave the 401k somewhere and just never look at it again. They just forget about it.
Julia Valentine is the author of Joy Compass, How to Make Your Retirement the Treasure of Your Life. She often speaks and conducts seminars around this issue around the country, and she was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Julia Valentine, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle. My pleasure.
Okay, and we all notice rising costs at the gas pump, but those costs will also mean rising prices for airline tickets. As NPR's Annie Baxter reports, that's already happening.
If you've been looking for a great deal on airline tickets recently, you've probably been disappointed.
Carriers have raised prices successfully twice so far this year, and that's out of four attempts, and I would expect another attempt literally within a week.
That's airline consultant Bob Mann. He says carriers have ways to reduce their exposure to higher prices by locking in fuel at a fixed cost in advance, a process called hedging. But Mann says carriers are never hedged 100%. So a spike in the cost of fuel, which is an airline's biggest line item of expense, usually translates to higher fares. And since Mann thinks fuel will only get costlier, he says it's best to book flights as soon as possible before fares shoot up more. But Rick Seeney, chief executive of the travel website FareCompare.com, disagrees somewhat. He says don't watch sites like his hawkishly for any hint of fuel-related price spikes for all your travel. Seeney says hurry to book if you're traveling in the next month or so. But for summer travel, he says it's best to shop about 3 months in advance.
That's when airlines start releasing some of their cheaper seats to test to see how the booking environment looks.
Seeney says fares in January were already up 9% from the year before. He thinks some travelers will get fed up with those rising costs and drive or take a train instead. But he says airlines can probably bank on business flyers suffering the price increases without too much pushback. Annie Baxter, NPR News.